This week on the Allegheny Front, a special look at how we humans relate to wildlife.
We want some animals out there, and that number is really hard to peg down and imagine how we're going to live with that number of animals.
From the species that could be affected most by a beefed up southern border wall in the U.S.
So what we're focused on here are vertebrate animals that cannot fly, mammals, except for bats, and then we're talking about amphibians and reptiles.
To the laws that govern how we treat animals.
And I think people at the time were extremely aware that business interests didn't have species interests at heart.
I'm Carol Holsapel. This week on the Allegheny Front, we're exploring our relationship to animals, including teddy bears. Stay with us. Countries recognize borders, but animals and plants don't. The Trump administration's proposed 2019 budget earmarks $1.6 billion to get construction started on a southern border wall between the U.S. and Mexico. It's got big implications for property rights, immigration, and trade. But what about the non-human species that live along the border or want to cross it? Well, our friends at Generation Anthropocene looked into it. That's a podcast based at Stanford University featuring stories and conversations about planetary change. Maddie Bellin is a student at Stanford, and she produced this story.
When most people think of an undocumented immigrant, they tend to picture a person crossing the border, often in search of a better life for themselves and their families. To an ecologist, though, undocumented immigrants can look a little bit different.
So what we're focused on here are vertebrate animals that cannot fly. Mammals, except for bats, and then we're talking about amphibians and reptiles.
This is Jesse Lasky, a biology professor at Penn State University. Jesse researches human impacts on biodiversity. Basically, how the stuff we build affects those mammals, amphibians, and reptiles. Back in 2011, he published a paper about what would happen to over 100 species if a border wall completely separated the U.S. and Mexico. In the wake of the 2016 presidential election, Jesse's once-buried paper has had a new life.
I've always kind of had it in my mind that this could come back, but it's maybe a little surprising that it's come back quite so strong. But I guess it shouldn't be based on the Trump campaign, because that was really a central promise that he made.
We will build the wall. Yes, we will build the wall. Build the wall. Build the wall. We will.
We tend to think of the U.S.-Mexico border as being mostly dry desert. But there's actually a much wider range of climate and habitats. A coast-to-coast border wall would be almost 2,000 miles long, and it would cut through lush coastal grasslands, searing hot deserts, and staggering mountain peaks. Jesse's research suggests that a border wall would be especially damaging in regions that have high levels of biodiversity. A lot of species depend on cross-border migration. And his research shows that a wall would block species from their daily travel to find food. On top of that, it would divide each species population into two smaller ones, limiting their ability to interbreed and spread genetic diversity.
You know, one major source of genetic diversity is dispersal from other populations. And if you stop that, then you likely get decreases in genetic diversity within populations. You know, we're concerned that lower genetic diversity might be a problem for the potential adaptability of a species in response to environmental change, like something like climate change.
You might expect the species at the border to be mostly little lizards, but it turns out there's actually a much wider variety.
Some examples of that might be like the American black bear, which is pretty widespread in North America, but starts to sort of peter out as you get down to the U.S.-Mexico border.
Black bears are an important example because there just aren't that many of them this far south. Jaguars are also not very common around the border, as the border represents the northern edge of their range. Right now, there's only one jaguar living in the United States. People call him El Jefe. If a border wall were built, he would be left without access to his preferred hunting grounds, and he would be isolated from all the other jaguars in Mexico. El Jefe would essentially be the last of his kind. But even if species have a healthy population size on both sides of the border, restriction of cross-border movements would have serious consequences for day-to-day survival.
Something like a bighorn sheep, which is widespread in North America, but not so much in Mexico. And we have this desert bighorn sheep that lives in the Southwest. And these populations are fairly small and threatened. And, you know, these things are grazing in a place that doesn't get a ton of rainfall. So, you know, they often have to move large distances to find grazing places and also to find mates.
It's clear that building a wall along the border would be potentially catastrophic for species that live there. On the other hand, there's already a lot of development along the border that has had an environmental impact. For example, large sections of a border wall were built during George W. Bush's time in office. So what makes Trump's proposed wall so different?
So one thing to note is that the kind of project they're talking about now would essentially be an impenetrable wall. So, you know, all those other things usually have some sort of openings and penetrability. But what they're talking about now is a solid concrete wall that's 30 feet tall or something like that. So that really stands out.
Dividing species by throwing a wall between them is already disruptive enough. But there's also climate change to factor in. Climate change poses a very real danger to all species, and that threat is amplified in the context of a border wall. As the planet warms, species may have to migrate northwards to live in the same temperatures they're used to.
And we do see lots of movement of the distributions of organisms in response to climate change. So this is something that's happening. If species weren't able to do that anywhere along the border, a lot of those things that would need to shift across the border to track their conditions might get squeezed there so that they would essentially have nowhere to go.
There are a lot of ways to study both climate change and negative human impacts on biodiversity. We asked Jesse why he even decided to look at this hypothetical future wall in the first place.
You know, this is really a large-scale infrastructure project, you know, among the largest scales you can sort of think of. You know, we don't often do in one fell swoop a project that covers, you know, four states and you know, all these very diverse ecosystems. So that was sort of the motivator there, which is, you know, this big project was being plopped down across the continent without really the typical environmental review process.
Let's pause on that for a moment. There are a lot of laws in place that should protect our environment from huge infrastructure projects like this. There's the Endangered Species Act, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act. The list goes on. But in 2005, Congress passed another law that can override all of these regulations. That law, called the Real ID Act, says that any major project pertaining to national security can ignore environmental regulations. So a 2,000-mile concrete wall, one of the biggest infrastructure projects you could possibly imagine, would not need to undergo any sort of environmental review process because it would be built under the auspices of national security. At the end of the day, though, it's impossible to know what the real effects of a border wall would be until after it actually gets built, if it gets built. There could be a lot of unforeseen consequences, so having at least one scientific study to examine the environmental issues is worthwhile.
That's why we tried to do our work to at least put something there where we might have some sense of what might happen. But it's really dramatically an outlier in that sense of the scope of it and the lack of information.
This proposed U.S.-Mexico border wall is certainly not the only one out there. Border walls are becoming more and more common in a post-9/11 world, especially in Europe and other countries experiencing an influx in migrants. Millions of refugees flee their homes and need to cross borders to get to safety. Obviously, the concerns about any border wall go well beyond the environment. But it is worth pointing out that when humans build walls to keep each other out, we also block the movements and threaten the survival of hundreds of other species besides ourselves. These animals share our lands, but not our borders, and especially not our border walls.
That was Stanford student Maddie Bellin with Jesse Lasky of Penn State University. And the story is from the podcast Generation Anthropocene in an episode titled, Oh Right, the Animals. In February, a federal judge rejected a lawsuit by the Center for Biological Diversity and an Arizona congressman to block the new southern border wall on environmental grounds. Their lawsuit claimed the administration needs to conduct an environmental review. And another update on this story. El Jefe, the jaguar, he hasn't been seen in a while. The Associated Press reported just last month that animal activists and wildlife officials suspect he might be dead, based on a photograph of a jaguar pelt which resembles his spot patterns. I personally hope this is a case of mistaken identity. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Well, jaguars like El Jefe, the cat that lived in the mountains between Arizona and Mexico, are endangered. The Endangered Species Act was signed by a Republican president in the 1970s, but now many Republicans want to weaken it. The act was meant, of course, to protect species facing the threat of extinction. Republicans in Congress are considering a variety of bills they say would modernize it, making it more business-friendly. But some Democrats and conservationists say bills like this would diminish the law's ability to save wildlife on the brink. To learn more about this, the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant spoke with Jennifer Kahn for our podcast, Trump on Earth. Kahn wrote an article in the New York Times Magazine this year titled, Should Some Species Be Allowed to Die Out?
Right now, the way the Endangered Species Act is structured is you're effectively required by law to try to save a species once it's made it onto the list. There are people who would say, gosh, that's not the most efficient way to do things. We end up pouring a ton of resources maybe into species that don't deserve that many resources. And then unless we expand the amount we spend on conservation, we have less to spend on other species. Within the conservation, kind of movement, this has actually been discussed for quite some time, almost since the ESA was first passed, this question of, is it actually the best law that we should have, or should we make it a little more subtle? The problem with it is the minute you try to make it a little more subtle and make it a bit more case by case, it opens the door to all kinds of challenges that are closer to what folks who would like to see the ESA weakened, usually for business purposes, kind of what they want. And ultimately what they want is, it's not about conservation. It's not about how to most effectively save the species that matter. It's about business interests. So probably most of the bills that have been proposed and are currently being debated, they're really not about, gosh, let's really try to make the Endangered Species Act a little more sensible. It's much more about, how can we log stuff? How can we build stuff? Can we weaken the scientific criteria? Can we make it harder to list things, all that.
Can you take us back a little bit as to why, this was passed and signed under Republican President Richard Nixon? Why was the Endangered Species Act seen as something that was necessary then? Why was it getting bipartisan support, and what was it intended to do back in the beginning?
I kind of knew it, but reading about it again, it kind of, it wakes you up and breaks your heart a little bit. Like, once upon a time, we were able to work together on things. It actually began, almost a century before that, but there was this sudden kind of dawning sense that, gosh, these plains used to be overrun with bison. There are carrier pigeons or all kinds of just wondrous things that we had here, the American, chestnut. And suddenly we just cut them down, we killed them, and a lot of stuff was gone. And there was a sort of a moment of suddenly thinking, oh my gosh, we need to slow this down. And so that actually felt like a genuinely pressing bipartisan concern.
And the idea was specifically that we as a country were going to make efforts to prevent species from going extinct.
Yeah, and I think people at the time were extremely aware that business interests didn't have species interests at heart, and that there needed to be a really strong ironclad law. That was actually a deliberate thing, that there weren't going to be loopholes, that businesses could use to say, oh, no, this is why we shouldn't set aside this tract of land. This is why we can't bother to save the species. Oh, we need a cost accounting of how much it costs to save a species. And if it costs too much, we don't have to do it. All those things were seen as things that business and development interests, largely, or drilling interests or logging interests, could use to get around the law. It was sort of uniquely powerful. And I think the conservation community rightly considers this as an absolutely landmark moment of finally deciding, this is going to be a priority. I think people often feel like it has to be defended so strongly, because if you give any ground, it's just going to go away. And so it makes it hard to have a nuanced discussion about it.
Last fall, we saw the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which administers the Endangered Species Act, decline to list 25 species that were under consider for protection. And the Trump administration said that the listing, quote, is not warranted at this time. Is this something that happens under every administration and we're just hearing about, we're just paying attention to this one? Or are we seeing something different here?
It's funny, because I actually assumed it was going to be like much more extreme under the Trump administration, that there's just going to be a wholesale push toward gutting this. And when I talked to Nora Apter at the Natural Resources Defense Council, she was like, no, honestly, this desire has always been there. There's always been these bills being floated. The difference this time is really that they might actually succeed. If you poll people, everybody likes the Endangered Species Act. And so really very few politicians or presidents were willing to sign off on something, even when there were special interests involved. You know, so you would get these Republican congressmen or senators who would want to push for it, but they just couldn't get enough support. But at least right now, you know, with control of both houses and a president who really environment is not, conservation is not a priority, this is the time. You know, this is the time when it can actually happen.
That was reporter Jennifer Kahn speaking with the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant for our podcast, Trump on Earth. There's more at trumponearth.org or wherever you get your podcasts. On an episode of the TED Radio Hour from NPR, host Guy Raz zoomed out for a holistic view of how humans interact with animals.
One of the things that really started to change the way we think about animals happened a little more than 100 years ago. It involved a U.S. president, a bear, a cartoonist, and a group of savvy toy makers. Writer John Wellam told the story on the TED stage.
So it was the fall of 1902, and President Theodore Roosevelt needed a little break from the White House, so he took a train to Mississippi to do a little black bear hunting outside of a town called Smeeds. The first day of the hunt, they didn't see a single bear, so it was a big bummer for everyone. But the second day, the dogs cornered one after a really long chase. But by that point, the president had given up and gone back to camp for lunch. So his hunting guide cracked the animal on the top of the head with the butt of his rifle and then tied it up to a tree and started tooting away on his bugle to call Roosevelt back so he could have the honor of shooting it. The bear was a female. It was dazed, injured, severely underweight, a little mangy looking. And when Roosevelt saw this animal tied up to the tree, he just couldn't bring himself to fire at it. He felt like that would go against his code as a sportsman.
Wow, what an awesome dude. I mean, he's just like, I'm not going to shoot it.
Yeah, he says, no thanks. Well, actually, that's sort of how we remember the story. Actually, what he says is, no thank you. And then he turns to his friend and he says, put it out of its misery.
Oh.
And his friend takes a Japanese hunting knife and slashes it open in the gut, and they carry it back to camp and they eat it.
That didn't really happen.
No, that really happened.
That really happened. They ate the bear?
They ate the bear. I mean, you have to think, Roosevelt is a hunter. You know, he's not a PETA activist. So that was merciful, you know, in his mind. But it just involved cutting the bear's gut open with a knife.
And a few days later, the scene was memorialized in a political cartoon by Clifford Berryman in the Washington Post. Not the knife moment, but the moment where Roosevelt decides not to shoot the bear. And the cartoon was called Drawing a Line in Mississippi.
And it showed Roosevelt with his gun down and his arm out, sparing the bear's life. And the bear was sitting on its hind legs with these two big, frightened, wide eyes and little ears pricked up at the top of its head. It looked really helpless, like he just wanted to kind of sweep it up into your arms and reassure it. It wouldn't have looked familiar at the time, but if you go looking for the cartoon now, you sort of recognize the animal right away. It's a teddy bear. And this is how the teddy bear was born. Essentially, toy makers took the bear from the cartoon, turned it into a plush toy, and then named it after President Roosevelt, Teddy's Bear.
And you can really trace that bear in the cartoon to the teddy bear, that sort of anthropomorphized, very cuddly-looking, somewhat pathetic-looking creature from Berryman's cartoon became the teddy bear.
Meanwhile, he's eating bear filet mignon in his tent.
Yeah, the last day they had roasted bear paws, I think was the last thing they had.
You did not learn that at the toy store.
No.
That was left out of the story.
And that's the point. I think it's cutting a bear open with a knife and, putting it out of its misery does not seem sympathetic now, although it did at the time.
So before all this happened, it didn't occur to anyone to make a cute, cuddly bear toy?
Right. You know, you didn't have bear toys unless the bears were these kind of scary monsters.
Even though it didn't really take long after Roosevelt's hunt in 1902 for the toy to become a full-blown craze, Most people figured it was a fad. It was a sort of silly political novelty item, and it would go away once the president left office. And so by 1909, when Roosevelt's successor, William Howard Taft, was getting ready to be inaugurated, the toy industry was on the hunt for the next big thing. They didn't do too well. That January, Taft was the guest of honor at a banquet in Atlanta. And for days in advance, the big news was the menu. They were going to be serving him a southern specialty, a delicacy, really, called possum and taters. So you'd have a whole opossum roasted on a bed of sweet potatoes, and then sometimes they'd leave the big, you know, tail on it like a big meaty noodle. The one brought to Taft's table weighed 18 pounds. So after dinner, the orchestra started to play, and the guests burst into song. And all of a sudden, Taft was surprised with the presentation of a gift from a group of local supporters. And this was a stuffed opossum toy, all beady-eyed and ball-eared. And it was a new product they were putting forward to be the William Taft presidency's answer to Teddy Roosevelt's teddy bear. They were calling it the Billy Possum.
So this really became a mascot for the Taft administration for, you know, a couple months. And as he started traveling the country, frequently people gave him live opossums in cages.
Wow.
So
I wonder how he felt about that. I mean, he's like, oh, another possum, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, there really were like stories in the New York Times that were like, the president was given another possum in Dallas yesterday, you know?
But even with all this marketing, the life of the Billy Possum turned out to be just pathetically brief. The toy was an absolute flop, and it was almost completely forgotten by the end of the year. And what that means is that the Billy Possum didn't even make it to Christmas time, which, when you think about it, is a special sort of tragedy for a toy. See, we can explain that failure two ways. The first, well, it's pretty obvious. I'm going to go ahead and say it out loud anyway. Opossums are hideous. But maybe more importantly is that the story of the Billy Possum was all wrong, especially compared to the backstory of the teddy bear. Think about it. For most of humans' evolutionary history, what's made bears impressive to us has been their complete independence from us. It's that they live these parallel lives as menaces and competitors. By the time Roosevelt went hunting in Mississippi, that stature was being crushed. And the animal that he had, roped to a tree, really was a symbol for all bears. Whether those animals lived or died now was entirely up to the compassion or the indifference of people. I'd argue that the invention of the teddy bear inside that story is a more important story, a story about how dramatically our ideas about nature can change, and also about how on the planet right now, the stories that we tell are dramatically changing nature. Because think about the teddy bear. For us, in retrospect, it feels like an obvious hit because bears are so cute and cuddly, and who wouldn't want to give one to their kids to play with? But the truth is that in 1902, bears weren't cute and cuddly. They looked the same, but no one thought of them that way. In 1902, bears were monsters. Bears were something that freaking terrified kids. For generations at that point, the bear had been a shorthand for all the danger that people were encountering on the frontier. And the federal government was actually systematically exterminating bears and lots of other predators too, like coyotes and wolves. These animals, they were being demonized. They were called murderers because they killed people's livestock. And so what I'm saying is the teddy bear was born into the middle of this great spasm of extermination. And you can see it as a sign that maybe some people deep down were starting to feel conflicted about all that killing. America still hated the bear and feared it, but all of a sudden America also wanted to give the bear a great big hug. Nature could only start to seem this pure and adorable because we didn't have to be afraid of it anymore. You can see that cycle playing out again and again with all kinds of animals. It seems like we're always stuck between demonizing a species and wanting to wipe it out, and then when we get very close to doing that, empathizing with it as an underdog, wanting to show it compassion. So we exert our power, but then we're unsettled by how powerful we are.
We're like a really bad boyfriend, humans, when it comes to animals. it's a totally schizophrenic relationship.
It absolutely is. And I think it's hard to, at the same time, I think it's really hard to be very critical of it, for me at least, because it's
It's understandable on both sides. You know, when we're really afraid of things, that's absolutely understandable. I don't want, you know, wild wolves racing through the city. I think a lot of kind of conservation-minded regular folk, we have this idea that we want some animals out there. And that number is really hard to peg down and imagine how we're going to live with that number of animals. So it makes sense that it would be constantly this kind of back and forth, this kind of flux of, you know, getting what we want and then not really being sure why we wanted it anymore.
What do you think the stories that we tell about animals, like, and the ones we pick to tell stories about, like, what do they say about humans?
I think they say all sorts of different things. I mean, we use these animals to say what we need to say sometimes. So I think that, you know, animals are these kind of convenient props to work out a lot of kind of deeper emotions and questions. I mean, I think it's the reason why when you look at a lot of children's books, they all have animal characters, even if the stories themselves have nothing to do with animals. I mean, we have like a book where a sort of ungainly pig that wants to be a figure skater and she tries really hard and she makes it. And, you know, that has nothing to do with pigs. It could have been a girl. But I think somehow creating these stories that involve animals, these lessons become more digestible somehow. And I think we do that all the time as adults too. I mean, I think when we talk about the need to save the bald eagle from DDT and other pollutants, you know, it's partly maybe because we think bald eagles are awesome and we want to see them flying around. But I think it's also partly a way to talk about our shame or our uncertainty about what we're doing to the planet.
The stories that we tell about wild animals are so subjective. They can be irrational or romanticized or sensationalized. Sometimes they just have nothing to do with the facts. But in a world of conservation reliance, those stories have very real consequences, because now how we feel about an animal affects its survival more than anything that you read about in ecology textbooks. Storytelling matters now. Emotion matters. Our imagination has become an ecological force. And so maybe the teddy bear worked in part because the legend of Roosevelt and that bear in Mississippi was kind of like an allegory of this great responsibility that society was just beginning to face up to back then. It would be another 71 years before the Endangered Species Act was passed. But really, I mean, here's its whole ethos, boiled down into something like a scene you'd see in a stained glass window. The bear is a helpless victim tied to a tree, and the President of the United States decided to show it some mercy. Thank you.
John Wellam, his latest book is called Wild Ones. Check out his full talk at ted.npr.org.
That was Guy Raz, the host of the TED Radio Hour from NPR. And we thank them for allowing us to re-air that segment from the episode Animals and Us. There's a link to the TED Talk and the story at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation.